All right, this is, I think, the middle part class, right? So it's, it must be the most important class, like Sefer Vayikra. We always say the middle is the most. No, that's what they say in Chazal. But okay, I don't know if it's true in Lost Synagogue Classics. Maybe we lost that. But anyways, part three of our five-part series, fascinating subject. This week is the Adler-Rutledge Machzor, so we'll let Yossi take it away. And okay, we'll look forward. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, I don't know if this is the most important class. I will say that the Machzor Siddur we're going to talk about is probably the most unknown. I have a copy. I don't know how much good it would. I don't actually. I should have brought it with me, I guess, to the class. But it doesn't do much to show the picture anyway of the outside because it just looks like any other Siddur or Machzor. The edition I have is the one that was published by the Hebrew Publishing company in the United States, and probably doesn't look so similar to the original either anyway, and it's just kind of a nondescript brown cover, but we'll, on the source sheet and stuff, we'll have some pictures of what it looks like inside, and we'll look at some of the text, so we'll get a better sense of what this is. But before I talk about that Machzor, I just want to talk a little bit actually about piyutim in general, Hebrew poetry that we say in our davening, because I think it gives us a good sort of window into what about this Machzor was interesting and different, particularly because it comes up in the way it deals with piyutim or Hebrew poetry. So let me share screen right away, and we'll share the source sheet, and we'll jump into it. Okay. All right, here we go. So as many of you probably know, piyutim, Hebrew poetry, they say in the Siddur, some of it is quite difficult. We have the Hoshanos, for example, that we say throughout Sukkot, and particularly on Hoshana Rabbah. There's these lengthy poems, I think even more well-known, obviously, the Kinos we say on Tisha B'Av, the Slichos we say particularly before Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and it's all very difficult Hebrew poetry. Probably some of you are also aware that many Orthodox Jews actually don't say as many piyutim as we once did, perhaps in Europe or something like that, and that over time we say less. I mean, the Art School Siddur, for example, has a section called Yotzros, which are on four Shabbos throughout the year, before, you know, leading up to Pesach, what they call the Arba Parshios. There are these additional piyutim, these insertions into the repetition of Chazaras HaShatz, of the repetition of the Shemona Esrei, and many congregations have dropped those over the years. There was piyutim that were said on Yom Tov in many Ashkenazic congregations in Europe, in Maariv also, actually, before Shemona Esrei, and in Shachris and Musaf, and a lot of Ashkenazi congregations today don't say those anymore. And I think this all kind of reflects the fact that they're very difficult. And they're very complicated. And people don't appreciate always this Hebrew poetry as much as they used to. They're very difficult to understand. I mean, I myself, without a translation, I'd be kind of lost in many of them. But what's also interesting to note is that throughout history, there's been vigorous debate among traditional Jewish sources and commentaries, halachic authorities as well, about whether we should even be saying this complex poetry. I will take, for example, in source... Well, before we get to source number one, actually, I should mention that Rabbi Elazar HaKalir is the author of many of these very difficult piyutim. He's probably lived in the 7th century in the land of Israel, and he was part of a school of authors of these piyutim where they, every, you know, it would be like sort of the excitement of the davening on Shabbos in the land of Israel at the time that they would write these new compositions to be inserted into the Shemona Esrei. And to be recited by the Chazan, but you know, over time, although we kept saying these in many places, they became harder to understand and often less exciting for people to say. But so we'll take, for example, in source number one, of Yaakov Emden in his Siddur, he has what to say about this. And translation might not be perfect; it's my own translation. It's a bit of a difficult source. It's actually interesting that he was upset about piyutim. So what does he do? He kind of writes a poem about them, kind of a piyut of his own. And he says about them, V'yasir b'dili ha-minhagim b'sigi piyutim asher haya b'ochreinu. Remove the tin-like customs and dross of the piyutim that oppress us. Lag v'kelos the svivos seder, they make us a laughing stock to those that surround us. Al kein ona ein ona ufona l'saka senu. Therefore, God does not answer or turn to us when we cry out. Gam hamalachim vada in makirim bilshonos hazaros v'hamishunos asher nisafer b'hem. Even the angels don't recognize the foreign and bizarre terms that are mixed up in them. Nilag lashon in bina, the stammering of tongues not understood. He's quoting a pasuki here. Ki ilu baname am ke safa, as if it comes from a people of speech too obscure to comprehend. Another pasuk. Takas asher hayinu hagala sigula mikol haamim ayedei lashonenu hakadosh v'atohar ko emes elo katrufa. And this is, you know, instead of the fact that we look instead like a stammering, non-comprehensible people instead of a treasured people among all nations because of our adherence to the language of Hebrew. So he's got some very strong words here about how Hebrew poetry is just not great, not something he likes. He's not the only one. If you look in source number 2, the Ibn Ezra, in his commentary to Koheles, it goes through a long discussion about how piyut is convoluted, is too midrashic, it's ungrammatical, in his long comment to Koheles, and I just copied for you this one line from toward the end of his comment on Koheles, and he says, V'lo uchal l'va'ar achad mini elef ma'ata osa paitanim. I cannot explain even 1,000 of the ways the paitanim are mistaken. V'ato be'nai sh'lo yispel adam bahem, ki imat tefillah kavua. People should just stick to the fixed prayers, Shema, Shemona Esrei, the brachos, all that, and don't recite all these extra piyutim. Now, Ibn Ezra himself wrote many piyutim, but he followed in the Spanish tradition a much different approach, where it's much less midrashic, much closer to the, you know, it's more appropriate Hebrew grammar. It's a little simpler to understand, and this is true of Sephardic piyut in general. It's really the Ashkenazi piyut, which is in particular the most difficult, the most obscure in terms of the midrashic references and stuff like that, and hard to understand. There are also, though, many defenders of piyutim over the years. Rabbeinu Tam was in the among the Tosafists in the medieval period in France, was probably the greatest defender of piyut. He felt that Rabbi Elazar HaKalir was himself actually one of the Tanaim. Now, it doesn't seem historically that really when he lived. He probably lived later, but Rabbeinu Tam's assignment of him as a Tana certainly increased his stature, increased the stature of piyutim a great deal. Another defender of piyutim is the Maharal, which we'll see here in source number 3. And this will, I think, help bring us into our discussion about poetry and translation of poetry and what it's trying to do. And I do have a translation here that I put as well on the next page. And he says, Ki ashiros sarach shimrosam besimcha uvituv leiv. When we sing, we have to say it happily. Shari nikra shira shira ba mitoch simcha, because song comes from a place of happiness. Batfila hu ba'achna yisera she'omei be'omeid v'yira. And when we say like the fixed prayers, we say them with a certain quality of submission, a certain stand in fear and say them, stand in reverence and say them. V'chola asher hu b'simcha midaber dvarim she'em rechokim kasher libo shel omer pasuach asumachot b'davar. And when you're happy, sometimes you say far-fetched things. You exaggerate when you're when your heart is open. V'chasher mafli b'shevach hu gam kem si b'shen aloshen kolkach muvan. And when you are saying all these praises and you're exaggerating, that kind of explains why the language is not so understandable. So he's saying in a really interesting way that piyut is difficult to understand because the people are so happy when you're supposed to be saying it, and sometimes you say things when you're happy that are hard to understand. If we go to the next part I underline. And when you're making this kind of exaggeration of statements, you speak in a way that people generally don't speak. And when we talk about the piyut that's said on Purim, this is the krova or krovets for Purim that is in the Siddur, but I don't know if people say it so much anymore. And there he says the miracle was very great. So the exaggeration is very great. And so the piyut exaggerates. Because the piyut wants to praise God and to sing. Because we're very, very sad on Tisha B'Av, and the sadness washes over us. And the language is kind of over the top because of the fact that we're so sad. So the Maharal gives this very interesting explanation for piyutim, and I think of putting what the Maharal is saying is that you can't really capture the emotion that we're trying to get from these times in regular language. And you, but it, and in poetry, you can say things that you can't say in prose. Poetry has rhyme schemes, it has an unusual structure, and it can convey feelings in a way that prose often cannot, even if it can sometimes be inscrutable. And Piyut, then, he's saying, is a prayer that's full of emotion, and that's how it's distinguished from the regular fixed prayers that we say on a regular basis. Now, it seems then, at least if we go in the Maharal's footsteps, that there is a great value to poetry in our prayer, and it can express something that the regular prayers cannot. If that's the case, how do we translate it? When it comes to translating these piyutim, should we just stick to the literal meaning of the words, kind of like we would maybe with other types of translations? Or should translation of poetry be treated differently? And the reason for this would be that if you translate it literally, you may lose something of the poetry itself in the translation. That often, as we saw, poetry itself is not the most literal, it's sometimes fanciful. And if you just translate that into another language, you may lose whatever it was trying to capture to begin with. Or alternatively, when you translate poetry, and as I said, we really need a translation of these piyutim to understand them, should we instead make them more like poetry itself? So if we're translating to English, let's write something that sounds poetic. Let's write something that sounds beautiful, maybe even unusual, in a way that captures that spirit of the original in some fashion. And this is kind of where we get to this machzor. And the question of how we do this translation then becomes a debate in the 20th century. I call it a transatlantic debate because there's one position originating from England, this machzor, and there's one position originating from the United States. So there have been translations of the Siddur and machzor into English for a long time. Already in the 1700s, there were some, and the 19th century as well. But around in the first decade of the 20th century, we have a very different kind of translation for the first time. There was a civil engineer by the name of Arthur Davis. He lived in Derby. It's a town in industrial England near Birmingham. Not very much Jewish life going on there, but he's a very religious Jew, and he later moves to London to take part in religious life there. And he has no formal Jewish education.
Sorry,
but he
pronounce what you call Derby, Derby. That's how it's pronounced in England.
Okay, say that again.
Derby. It's
Derby. Okay, thank you. I appreciate the clarification. Yeah. And he spent much of his free time on Jewish learning and scholarship, and really was self-taught and taught himself a great deal. He took particularly great interest in translation, this Mr. Arthur Davis. And if you see in source number 4, this is a little quote from the machzor itself. I'll read you and then I'll explain where this is from. About the year 1900, he first conceived, this is Arthur Davis, the idea of making a new translation of the festival prayers. Realizing the inadequacy of existing English renderings to express the form and beauty of the compositions that make up the Jewish liturgy, he aimed at the production of a new translation more worthy of the original. So this is Herbert Adler writing about his collaborator, Arthur Davis. So Arthur Davis started translating the Machzor, but he passed away. He passed away in the middle of the translation. And Herbert Adler, who was the nephew of the chief rabbi of England at the time, Herman Adler, completed the Machzor. And when we talk about a Machzor, we're not just talking about Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, but we're talking about all the Shalosh Regalim, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot, because, as I said, there was traditionally in Nusach Ashkenaz, there's a great deal of piyutim that are added to the davening that are incorporated into this machzor. And what Arthur Davis and Herbert Adler did was they created a new translation. And as he says, it's a translation that expresses the form and beauty of the compositions more worthy of the original. So already we get the hint, this is going to be kind of a poetic translation. This is going to be something new. Now, who did the translations? So Arthur Davis did a lot of the translation himself. As I said, he was very interested in translation. He was self-taught. He learned a lot about how to do this. But he also had his two daughters assist him. It says here in the source number 4, commencing with the Kol Nidre service with the assistance of his daughters, Elsie Davis and Nina Davis, now Mrs. Redcliffe Salomon, he embarked on the work of translation. It says he did the prose. And then it continues and it says that the other person they got to help out was Israel Zangwill. Israel Zangwill, which we'll talk about in a moment, was a very, very famous author in England at the time. So we don't know very much about his daughter, Elsie Davis. We do know a lot about Nina Salomon, though. I have her picture here on the source sheet. And she was really a very interesting, an interesting figure in British Jewry at the time. She was born in 1877. She raised six children, I believe. Her husband was very wealthy, Redcliffe Salomon. There's actually a book that was recently written about him. I haven't taken a look at that yet. But she had some time to pursue scholarship as well. And she authored books of translations, including she translated Yehuda Alevi's poetry. She wrote some of his poetry for the Jewish Quarterly Review, an important journal. And in 1919, she became the first woman in England to give the sermon in an Orthodox synagogue after Shabbat services. People were upset. Some people were upset about this, but the chief rabbi at the time, Rabbi Hertz, who we talked about in our first class, actually defended her and said, this is totally okay. This is after davening. This is not, you know, part of the davening. We're allowed to have a woman do this. And so she was clearly a very, very educated person. She kept a kosher home in Shabbos. And she did a number of the translations for this machzer. She was very close to Israel Zangwill. They were all part of the same circle of writers. And when she passed away of cancer, unfortunately, in 1925, Zangwill called her the spiritual queen of Anglo-Jewry. In source number 5, we're going to get a little bit of a sense of how she translates, what her poetry is like. We're not going to pay like a great attention here to the Hebrew. I think I'm more just actually looking at the English. This is one of the Hoshanos that is said on Hoshana Rabbah. And listen to the way, I'll read a little bit, listen to the way she translates. O save, we beseech thee, that's Ana Hoshiana. I beseech thee, give ear to their cry that implore thee to save, that seek to give joy unto thee with the willows that wave, O save. I beseech thee, deliver the stock thou hast planted, and say on the day when thou sweepest the remnant of nations away, I will save. So what, actually I'll let just anyone want to comment briefly, what's the thing that strikes you most about this translation, just looking at it? Can I read one more? Yeah, it rhymes, exactly. Yeah, this is a rhyming translation. I mean, obviously it has the these and thous, which you talked about a little last time, that are kind of antiquated, but at the time were used very widely in liturgical translation and stuff like that. But yeah, it rhymes. Instead of trying to make a precise correspondence with the Hebrew, she is writing a poem with a rhyme scheme. In this one, she has each part of the verse, rhyming. It's very interesting. If you look, for example, at the way Art Scroll translates in 1984 in source number six, you see something very different. There's no attempt to rhyme. It says, please listen to the plea of those who long for your salvation. With brook willows they bring you joy and bring salvation now. Please redeem the garden of your planting as you sweep away Duma and bring salvation now. It's a much more literal type of translation. Again, I'm not going to get into the whole how exactly each was translating the Hebrew, and as I think these are very difficult poems. But all I really want to show with that is just to show how she takes the poem and she wants to make it into a poem in English as well. And she creates a rhyme scheme. I actually, here in source number 7, I copied for you just a piece of independent poetry that she wrote, also a piece of Jewish poetry. It's reprinted. She printed in one of the books, a poetry she published. I just thought it was interesting to see like when we're talking here about the translation of this machzer, they got someone, I mean, Nina Salomon, who was herself a poet, not just any run-of-the-mill sort of translator, but someone who wrote independent poetry, because they really felt that was an important part of how to translate the machzer. If you look at this poem about Tisha B'Av, I'll read it. I don't want to spend a lot of time discussing it, but I do think it's very interesting. She says, "Hast thou forgotten forever, Lord? Thou art silent so long. Hast thou forgotten, O Master? Forgotten our day of disaster, our life that is barren of song? Hast thou forgotten forever? Why art thou silent so long? Thou sitting throned on the heavens, with earth lying prone at thy feet. If thou hast ceased to remember, tread out our flame till the ember lie cold and the gloom be complete. Look once from thy throne on the heavens and crush out the life at thy feet." And that's the end of the poem. It's kind of a little disturbing, I guess, and what she's doing here. Anyone want to say anything about the poem? Any thoughts about it come to mind? Well, I'll just say a couple words about it. I think you see again that this is poetry with a rhyme and everything. I think in terms of the content, she seems to be criticizing Hashem for not taking enough notice of us, not bringing the redemption, seeming to forget us, which, despite being perhaps theologically daring, is something we do on Tisha B'Av in many of the kinos as well. That we do sort of call out and say, "Hey Hashem, why have you been silent? Why have you not redeemed us?" This is something we do on Tisha B'Av. I think the end of this poem is particularly interesting. She's saying, if you've really forgotten us, why don't you just finish it? Which is, I think, a particularly daring thing to say and difficult thing to say. But I think she is providing some solace at the end. The fact that Hashem hasn't done this, but the fact that we're still here, is that, can show that Hashem does care about us, that he hasn't forgotten us, and that he will bring the Geula at the end. At least that's certainly one way you can sort of read the poem to provide some measure of consolation. Anyway, we see this is a woman who is translating the Masa, but she's also a poet who writes deep poetry, who writes thoughtful poetry. And she brings this sentiment, this poetic sensibility to her translation of the Machzor, this Machzor that was published by Arthur Davis. Okay, let's look now at source number 8. So we're going to talk about the other translator. The other translator being Israel Zangwill. Actually, let me look at source number 9, because then you can see a picture of Zangwill. So who was Zangwill? He's a very different figure than Nina Salomon. He's a novelist. He's a playwright. He's a Zionist, although a controversial Zionist. He was the one who was what we call, I think, a territorialist. He was one of the people who advocated to settle the Jews in Uganda, which was then voted down by the Seventh Zionist Congress in 1905. It was called the Jewish Territorialist Organization. He wanted to find a safe haven for Jews wherever, even outside of the land of Israel. He also popularized the term melting pot in his 1909 play of that name, and he was perhaps, what his biography says, he was perhaps the best-known English-speaking writer in the Jewish world at the time. Now, he was not traditionally religious. He was married to a non-Jew, and in fact, he declined to circumcise his eldest son, which I copied for you, his little statement about that he wrote about this in 1926. He says, "So little racial am I that I have not made my eldest born a son of the covenant. I cannot, with my vision and knowledge of history, carry on the 19th century old tradition of trying to sit between two stools. Before the war, a Maida Vale Jew offered to send a £5 note to any charity I pleased if I would tell him if my son was circumcised. I was sorry to rob a charity, but I left the inquisitive letter unanswered. If the writer is still alive, as I hope, he can send the fiver to the Jewish refugees stranded by the pitiless America's immigration policy. I will add, and he may perhaps rise it to a tenor at the glad news, that my younger son is circumcised, but that was only because the doctor advised that circumcision has in fact become so popular a prophylactic that it can no longer connote the covenantal isolation of the Jew." So he is pretty against many very important traditional religious observances like circumcision. He also, in the same essay, he has a statement which makes it sound like he'd be okay if, like, the New Testament was added to our Tanakh as well. He was a universalist. he really wanted everyone sort of to be part of one big melting pot in the sense of religions, I guess. So it's interesting that he was also involved in this Master Translation. I think one reason he was involved was because he was a really good and famous writer of the time. He was also very involved in the United Synagogue his whole life in Jewish causes. And in England, a lot of the distinctions that we make between different denominations are just not as pronounced. So many more people of varying religious levels, my understanding is, are part of the United Synagogue, even if they might not be as observant. He and Arthur Davis were also part of this group called the Kilburn Wanderers, which was an intellectual circle that had formed around Solomon Schechter, who was a Cambridge scholar who was famous, among other things, for discovering the Cairo Geniza, or not discovering the Cairo Geniza, but popularizing the Cairo Geniza. And, you know, so they were all kind of, this group, they were all kind of friends. So Zangwill, being a very prominent writer, was asked to translate. So like Solomon, we're going to see over here that Zangwill has a translation that is very poetic and, in his case, not particularly literal. And I think this is a really fascinating one here in source number 8. This is the Master again. This is the Yom Kippur one. The Master was published in a number of volumes by I believe the publisher was Routledge. I think that's how they pronounce it in England. I think. And this is they had a separate one for Kol Nidre for the Friday night. The Yom Kippur night service. And this is one of the piyutim we say Amnam Kein that you may be familiar with. So I'm going to do a little demonstration here. Hopefully this will go over okay. We'll do some singing. I'm not Cantor Malavani, but I'll do my best. So this is, I'm going to sing in the traditional, what I was told was the traditional British tune for this piyut. So we'll start in Hebrew. We'll do the first verse in Hebrew and then, okay. So, Am Nahum Kein Yetzer Sochein Bonu Bach Lehatzdek Rav Tzedek Va'aneinu Salachti. Now, what's particularly interesting about Zangwill's translation here is I can sing it in English too. I tis thus, evil us, I hath in bond by thy grace, guilt efface, and respond forgiven. I'm pretty sure you can't do that with the Art Scroll translation. What he's done over here, and you can see this if you look at the translation here on the source sheet, he has copied the rhyme scheme, he's copied the meter, and he's created an English acrostic to match the Hebrew acrostic. So if we have, you know, Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Hey, he's got A, B, C, D, E, F, G. He's created a poem essentially that matches the Hebrew exactly in terms of the poem, but not in terms of the translation. His translation is not literal at all. I think one really good example is if you just look at the last line over here. He says, you have in the last line here, he says, Timcha, Timcha Pesha La'am Nosha V'somar Salachti. So how does he translate that? I would translate something like, he absolves sin for the nation that's saved and say, forgiven. What does he have over here? Zion's folk, free of yoke, O Asher, forgiven. Well, I guess Zion's folk is supposed to be La'am Nosha, not very literal translation. Sion doesn't appear. Timche Pasha, free of yoke. Interesting. Also, I guess it's a very liberal translation of forgiving sin. I guess they're free of the yoke. They're free of the yoke of sin. So I'm not saying again that this is something like wrong with this, or that this is like, you know, this is completely out of bounds to do. But it's a very liberal approach to translation, a very different approach than what we might see nowadays. It really focuses on the poetic aspects of it and less on the literal meaning of it. I think I did put, did I put the art, yeah, well, okay, yeah, I'll just show you quickly. So just a tiny bit of the Art Scroll translation here. Let's see. If you look in source number 15 over here, at the very beginning, he has, it is indeed true that passion rules us, So it is for you to justify, O abundantly just, and to answer us, I have forgiven. This is a much, you know, more basic translation, compared to Zangwill's, which is not nearly as literal. This I tis thus, evil us hath in bond, by thy grace gild a face and respond forgiven. Very different approach to translation that we see, in this Machzor. So, my understanding is that this Machzor was very popular. This became the Machzor in England and used very widely. I think up until very recently in England, it was being used until I think Rabbi Sachs did some additional translations and those are more in vogue now in England. If someone who is in England or familiar with the scene there wants to pipe up and comment and let me know how widely used this Machzor was, but I understand it was pretty widely used.
I'm in Canada and I can't remember what the Machzor was. It could well have been the Adler Machzor, but I specifically remember this translation.
Okay.
And this is years ago. It made an impression on me at the time that it sort of stuck through all these years.
Yeah, it's a very impression-making translation. It was also reprinted in other Machzorim. For example, the Silverman Machzor, this was the one the conservative movement published in 1939, I believe, and they actually copied this translation. And they cited Zangwill as the translator. So it was definitely copied to other Machzorim too.
The Routledge Machzor was 100% used in England.
Yeah.
100% until the last, I don't know, 10 years. The Art Scroll crept in and then the Koran crept in. But like the Herz Chumash and the Singer's Prayer Book, the Routledge Machzor was 100% used in England.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for the confirmation. That's what other people have told me as well. I have someone in my community who came from England, and he had brought with him the whole set of the Machzor, which, you know, and he laments to me also the fact that in America we just don't say as many of the Piyutim in general, which I think are still in more commonly said in England to this day.
Less and less so. They used to say the Maravas in the festival evening, in the evenings, in the Mariv of the Chagim, the Piyutim much less so. But there is a great deal more to say about Nina Salomon and the whole crowd. But the part of the thing was that the publishers, Routledge, were owned by the Franklin family, who were an old Anglo-Jewish family and really kept the Machzor going for years and years and years and years. Yeah, one of their members was, of course, the scientist Rosalind Franklin, who was part of the group that discovered DNA and was never really acknowledged until quite recently.
Yeah. Oh, very interesting. Okay, I didn't know that part of the history.
I grew up in Toronto, at the Sherei Shemayim. And we use the Adler Mach. I remember the Adler Mach. I have a copy somewhere. I don't know where it is. But that's what was used in Sherei Shemayim until I left Toronto when I was 22 in 1970.
Yeah, no, thank you. That's also good to hear. Yeah, all this confirms my impression that this was used widely in many places. As I said, the edition that I was able to obtain is from the Hebrew Publishing Company, published in the 50s. This is an American copy of it. But again, like, it had enough interest that they were publishing it in America as well.
I know that in various history books, there are very serious on different topics, and the publisher is the Routledge, and a lot of academic books. Is that the same publisher, or are there two Routledges?
I don't know, actually. I would assume they were the same publisher. I assume it's a big publisher, and they have published, you know, as you said, academic books as well. I mean, I have also, yes, I've seen that publisher listed. I'm assuming it's the same. I'm not sure offhand, though.
Same. It's the same publisher.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Yeah. Okay. So let me continue now. Let's have, here is marked as part three. And we'll start shortly with source number 10, but the controversy, because as we said, I think I've set out, there's a very clear approach to translation here. It's very poetic in this machzor, and some people were not too amused. One of the people who was not amused was Dr. Philip Birnbaum. We are going to devote a whole class to Dr. Birnbaum, the next class, so look forward to that. I just want to talk here particularly about his approach to translation that differentiated him from the other in particular. So his machzor and siddur are very popular, as we're going to talk about next time. He kind of captured the American market very, very quickly in 1949 with his siddur, 1951 with his Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur machzor, but he has a very different approach to translation. And if you look here in source number 10, which is from his introduction to the siddur, he says, a good translation ought to be authentic and free from deceptions. One must not read into the original what is not there. No new poetry should be introduced into the siddur, presumably as the translation of the Hebrew text. So he seems in a veiled way, but he seems to be criticizing the approach of the Adler Machzor, which was very poetic, as we said. Later in his introduction, he talks specifically about the Hoshanot, those prayers we say on Sukkot. He says the siddur contains prayer poems which should be annotated but not translated. Such are the Hoshanos, replete with historical and midrashic allusions and constructed in and involve poetic fashion. They comprise many intricate acrostics, a variety of Hebrew synonyms, which, if translated, are likely to create a wrong impression and confuse the reader. One of these prayer poems is composed of an interesting alphabetic list of 22 Hebrew synonyms for the temple. Another presents an alphabetical description of Israel's qualities. A third enumerates types of locusts and destructive forces of nature mentioned in the Bible. It may well be said that the additions that have included the available English translation of the Hoshanoth have not been enhanced by it. Again, I think he's talking about the Adler Machzor. The Hoshanos can be appreciated only in the Hebrew. So he doesn't even translate the Hoshanos in his Machzor because he feels it's just, there's no way to appreciate the complicated nature of the Hebrew in English, so let's not even bother. If you look in source number 11, this is, I think, the most, a very, very pointed reference to why it is upset with the Adler Machzor. And this is, we get to Amnam Cain. We just talked about Israel Zangwill's very non-literal translation of Amnam Cain. So you have Birnbaum's much more literal translation up here. He says, I copied a couple lines. You know, yes, it is true, an evil impulse controls us. Thou canst clear us, merciful one, so answer us. Okay. So then if you look at the footnote, and I copied for you here the footnote in the Machzor, and I think this is the only, I don't know, I haven't seen other places in the Machzor where he does this. He actually calls out another translator by name and disagrees with him. And he says, Zangwill's translation of the hymn was an attempt to preserve the meter, rhyme, and alphabetical acrostic of the original Hebrew at the expense of interpretive clarity and readability. For example, and he actually will quote this translation that we said and sang above, and he's very unhappy. He's very unhappy with this. So we see that Dr. Birnbaum is taking a very different approach to its translation. He says it should be literal, it should be clear, it should be simple, and we should not worry about it making it poetic. That is his approach, sort of a very different approach.
Although it seems that his translation is somewhat more poetic than the Art Scroll.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's true. And I think, let me come back to that in a little bit. But yes, I think that's right. I think Art Scroll tries to be even more literal, which we're going to show toward the end. And Birnbaum still is a little more poetic. I think that's right.
The old English telephone directory is more poetic than the Art Scroll translation.
Sure, sure. Okay, let's leave that for about 10 minutes, and I'm going to get back to that. Okay, so I think, though, where this controversy between Birnbaum and Zangwill becomes most apparent is in his review in source number 12 of the RCA Siddur. Now, again, I'm kind of presaging what we're going to talk about in the final class. I'm devoting a whole class to sort of the RCA's approach to the Siddur. We're going to go through the different editions of the RCA Siddur in class number 5, but this is specifically about the Siddur that the RCA published in 1960. They used in that, the translator was Rabbi Dr. David DeSola Poole, who was the rabbi of Sheirith Israel in the on the Upper West Side. He was from London, and he is, I think, he's a fan generally of the Adler Machzor's approach to translation in general. And he uses a lot of Zangwill's translations and Nina Salomon's translations, and that the whole group, he took a lot of the translations from the Adler Machzor and he incorporated them into his 1960 sitter for the RCA. And Dr. Birnbaum just goes to town. Birnbaum wrote a Hebrew review in Hadoar in 1960. And he really goes to town on Zangwill's approach to translation and the RCA in general. He says, Hayitakin Sherabanim Hirshiras Targume Yisrael Zangwill, She'enim Targumim Elechikuyim Chafshi'im Achadurim Tsurus Haba Me'olam Acher. Could it be that the rabbis of the RCA improved the translations of Israel Zangwill that are not translations, but free imitations infused with expressions from another world? What other world? He says, Olam HaNatzrus. This is the world of Christianity. I don't want to run out of time here, so let me just read here in English the rest of this. It's my translation, so any mistakes here are mine. In the prayer for rain, for example, Zangwill calls Avram Avinu thy blessed son, and Moshe Rabbeinu thy shepherd son. Even though the Paitan Rabbi Lazar HaKalir never mentions the word son in the original Hebrew at all. The extent to which Zangwill's translation does not overlap with the Hebrew is proven from the last line, Tefen ki nafshenu afufumayim. He translates, it's got to be seen to be believed, like this, without thy face their spirits whirl as in a swirl. Zangwill's translation not only has the odor of the Christian liturgy wafting from it, but sometimes he is assisted by free translations because he did not understand the meaning of the world. So a very, very sharp, very, very sharp critique of Zangwill over here. I copied for you just a little bit of Zangwill's translation below. And he says, he translates over here. And you can see this part about the sun. So if you look in the Hebrew, it's Zechor Av Nimshach Acharecha Kamayim Virachtu Ke'ez Shasul Al Palgei Mayim. It says, remember one who followed thee as to the sea flows water. Thy blessed son, like tree well set where rivers met. It just says Beirachto Ke'etz Shasul Al Palgei Mayim. Bless him like a tree that's planted by the waters. It doesn't say anything about thy blessed son, as Birnbaum points out. It's not a literal translation. Zangwill for some reason adds those words, probably for the needs of the poetry. And Birnbaum is very upset about this. I should mention though, one can't forget that Zangwill was also the RCA sitter was a competitor to Birnbaum's sitter, so he may have been upset about it partially for that reason. Also, I do wonder if we talked about how Zangwill was not particularly religious, as really an understatement, and that maybe that Birnbaum was also upset about the fact that he was involved in this translation project, especially in the RCA sitter, despite his own religious leanings. But the RCA responded to this. Rabbi Charles Chevelle, who's perhaps most well known today for his translation of the Ramban's commentary on the Torah. He was the main editor of the RCA sitter. Tzolo Poole was the translator, but Dr. Chevelle was the editor, and he responds to Birnbaum's critique in Hadoar, and actually they go back and forth several times in the pages of Hadoar, the two of them, fighting back and forth, quite passionately. This controversy actually really made quite a few waves. The editors of Hadoar say it was even mentioned on the radio show of Rabbi Pinchas Teitz of Elizabeth, New Jersey, who ran a popular Yiddish radio show on Saturday night. And the RCA was kind of, was burned a little from this controversy. In the second printing, they made some changes. A lot didn't take out Zangwill's translations. Rabbi Soloveitchik, who was listed on the title page of the Siddur in the first edition, his name was removed from the flyleaf on the new edition. Not completely clear why, but perhaps he didn't want his name to be associated and make it seem like he had approved every aspect of the translation of this RCA sitter. So here's just one piece of what Chevelle responds to Birnbaum. And he says, Mataras ha-targum sidurenu hulisaberas ozan ayhudi americani. Our translation was for an American Jew. Shesvato anglit matbeah halashon hevrit zara lerucho. He doesn't really know the style, the Hebrew style. He speaks English. Kadesh yavin, you want to show the loftiness and the beauty of the prayer. Therefore, we need to contend with forms of prayer that are for the language of the country. And then he continues, and I'll continue here again in English. He says, our organization never intended, God forbid, for the translation to substitute for the Hebrew original. I need not even mention that the RC rabbis ask and require their congregants to pray in Lashon HaKodesh. The translation is to explain, not to recite. Zengel's translations, and we only use them for piyut, the recitation of which is not important from a halacha perspective, are not precise, and the translator works poetically, not literally. Even though we are not obligated to defend Zengel, still we are sure that he knows the difference between singular and plural. So he's saying a lot of things here, but the basic idea is that the translations in the RSA Machzor, including the ones of Zangwill, are lofty and they use this complicated language because they're trying to give a taste of the Hebrew poetry itself and the complicatedness and loftiness of that poetry. They're not to be recited though necessarily. They're just to give a sense of that. And he admits that Zangwill's translations are not literal, but he feels that they're in the spirit of the piyut themselves. That by definition, piyut is more poetic, less literal. So we see here these two opposing sides. We see Birnbaum on one side, who's saying, no, I want a literal translation. We shouldn't be introducing new poetry. And the RCA, which copies Zangwill's and other and Nina Solomon's translations, and says, you know, no, for the American Jew, we're trying to make a more poetic translation, a more beautiful translation, so you can appreciate some of the poetry of the original Hebrew. So these are sort of the sides of the debate, as we've got. So let me now talk about, so where have we gone with this? In the years, Birnbaum was Siddur was popular for a very long time, as we'll talk about. The Adler Routledge Machzor was used for a very long time, as we've talked about. But as we all know, Art Scroll is kind of eclipsed everything, in this regard. And so Art Scroll takes things in a different direction. I'll say that Art Scroll is certainly more in the Birnbaum camp than in the RCA, Adler camp, in terms that he's pretty literal. But I think that Art Scroll is even more literal. Over here in source number 15, you'll see that Art Scroll tries to, in this piyut of Amnam Cain, Art Scroll tries to translate each occurrence of the word the same. So, for example, if you look back at Birnbaum, let me go back here to Birnbaum for a second. When Birnbaum does this piyut, he has Bach lahatzdek rav tzedek v'aneinu tzalachti in the second line of the bet. He says, "Those thou canst clear us, merciful one, so answer us." Okay, so he's just going to translate rav tzedek as merciful one and Bach lahatzdek as thou can clear us. Art school tries to translate tzedek the same in both cases. So he says, Bach lahatzdek, so it is for you to justify lahatzdek. Oh, abundantly just, Rav Tzedek. So actually, I kind of like this better, the way Art Scroll does it, in this particular instance at least. But Art Scroll, you can see already, there's a lot of literalism going on. Art Scroll wants to translate each word of the Hebrew the same way. Where we start to see more sort of this infelicity, I would say, of Art Scroll's translations, this maybe even phone book-like quality to the Art Scroll translations that Paul mentioned before, I just gave this example of Ashrei. This is the Art Scroll Siddur, how they translate one of the lines of Ashrei. Ritzon yiravya aseh ve'eshav asam yishma v'yoshi'em. The will of those who fear him, he will do, and their cry, he will hear and save them. Anyone just want to say quickly, what is Art Scroll doing? What are they doing with the syntax of this sentence?
Well, they're keeping it the same as in the original Hebrew.
Right, they're keeping exactly the same. So v'yoshi'em is at the end, so he puts it, and save them. I might say something like, he does the will of those who fear him, and he will hear their cry and save them. I don't know, you know, and he will hear their cry and save them, or something like that, but they've really broken it up so it matches the sentence structure of the original Hebrew exactly. And this is often the modus operandi of Art Scroll, that they do this persistently throughout their translation. And there's actually a reason why Art Scroll is doing this. And I put here in source number 17, Rabbi Nelson Sherman, one of the editors of the Art Scroll series, how he explains this in the introduction. He says, the men of the Great Assembly had the ability to combine letters, verses, and ideas in ways that unlock the gates of heaven. Their composition of the tefillah is tantamount to an act of creation, which is why it is so important not to deviate from their language and formulation. This is not to denigrate the importance of comprehension and emotional involvement. Prayer in the language one understands is sanctioned by the sages themselves, and surely a well-understood prayer is immeasurably more worthy than one that is merely mouthed as a string of uncomprehended sounds. Nevertheless, this does not detract a whit from the importance of praying in the holy tongue. It merely points up the responsibility to understand the prayers in their original holiest form. So what Rabbi Sherman is saying here, and I think the best way is actually this article I found from Rabbi Eli Fisher, who himself is a translator, explaining what Rabbi Sherman is saying here, source number 18. He says, in other words, the goal of the translation is solely to enable the reader to understand the original Hebrew. To that end, the closer to an exact correspondence the translation adheres, the easier it is for the reader to keep one finger on the original and one on the translation, using the latter as a lexicon for decoding the meaning of the former. All questions of style, idiom, and art, any literary element beyond that of basic comprehensibility, are rendered largely irrelevant in comparison with the main objective of facilitating comprehension of the metaphysically charged original. So he's saying that when we talk about Hebrew, translation of the Hebrew in our scrolls' view, there is no purpose in trying to make it pretty, because the whole point is just to make it easier to understand the English and understand the original Hebrew. And we're not trying to make it pretty. We're not trying to make it poetic, because the Hebrew is the main thing here, and the English is simply a sideshow. So we're not going to beautify the English in any way. And that's Art School's approach, which is why Art School's approach is often so different than the approaches we saw before, particularly than the approach that we've spent some time on here of the Adler Machzer, that is trying to make pretty poetic translation. That Art School is not interested in doing that. I'm sorry. Okay. Let me say a little bit more, just conclude here, and then I can leave a little bit more time for questions. So it's actually interesting, though. I think Art School's approach has won out, but we do see some movement in other directions as well. If you look over here in source number 19 over here, Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, when he translated for the Koran Machzer, he does sometimes slip back at Koran Siddur, he does sometimes slip back into poetry. This is Adon Olam. And you can see his translation of Adon Olam is actually kind of poetic. It actually rhymes. He says, Lord of the universe, who reigned before the birth of anything, when by his will all things were made, then was his name proclaimed king. He has some very nice lines in here, too. He says, when it comes to Hu Keli V'Chai Goali, he translates over here, he is my God, my Redeemer lives. He is the rock on whom I rely, my banner and my safe retreat, my cup, my portion when I cry. It's a pretty piece of poetry that he has here in translation. So we do see a little bit of that movement away back in the other direction towards what the Adler Machzer was doing. What's also fascinating is the RCA, and we'll talk about this more in the last class, that the RCA published a new sitter in 2019, and they actually put back in the translations of Israel Zangwill and Nina Solomon and others for many of the Hoshanos on Sukkot. They actually put those back in. They just copied them, those same old poetic translations from over 100 years ago. I guess what we're left with kind of is a question then of what is the best way to translate? Art School's approach is very straightforward. Just translate as literally as possible, increase comprehension, stick to the original. But Arthur Davis, Nina Solomon, Israel Zangwill wanted to inspire worshipers that in a way that would befit prayer's very exalted nature. This idea of putting poetry in there. It's actually interesting, and there may be something of a divide, I guess, across in different countries as well. In this regard, I was struck actually after Queen Elizabeth II died, I watched the service they had for her at London St. John Wood Synagogue. I watched it online, and it was really interesting. It's just very different from my perspective what you would see in America. It had like these chazanim, it had two different choirs, it had special prayers for the occasion they had in Hebrew and English. It closed with God Save the King. All the assembled dignitaries all stood up and exited the room while the people had to. All people had to remain in their seats until they had left. It's sort of a much more kind of formal formal approach than I'm used to in the United States. And I think this sort of also, we have to sort of understand the Adler Machzor and its translation in this context. You can imagine these, it's a decorous kind of approach. We want to make a beautiful English translation to be fit this exalted nature of prayer. And as I said, next time we'll talk about Dr. Philip Birnbaum, Sitter and Machzor, and I think we'll see something not just about his approach to translation, but also his whole vision for Jewish observance and education. With that, let me leave this open now for questions. Let me start with the chat, though. Okay. Yeah, Todd Endelman wrote The Last Anglo-Jewish Gentleman about Radcliffe Solomon. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Paul Schriebel says Zangwill was also cremated on his death. Very, very unusual at the time, 1924. That's very interesting.
Hmm.
Okay. Yeah, and there's definitely more to say on, yeah. So Chaim Malk says our shul used the Adler Machzor. The rabbi pointed out to me that at least one part of the translation was sacrilegious. In V'chol Ma'aminim, it translates Halan B'Seser B'Tzeel Shakai as who dwelleth in secret in the shadow of the Almighty. It leaves appear to refer to Jesus. That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, part of Birnbaum's critique of Zangwill's translations is he also feels there are other parts where he thinks it kind of can be interpreted in a Christian way. I have a hard time imagining that it's hard to imagine that was the intention, but it does some of the things are easy certainly to misinterpret.
May I comment on that?
Yeah, sure.
A year ago, Peter Robinson did an interview in Fiesole in Italy with three interesting personalities, one of whom was Tom Holland. These are all, two of them are for sure non-Jews, Christians, but they don't count themselves necessarily as Christians. But Tom Holland made the point, which I think is very relevant, that you can't get away from the fact that even in the modern secular world, he said something like the following words: we swim in a sea, in a Christian sea, no matter what, in the secular world. And therefore, anybody living in the modern secular world is going to be influenced by those kinds of things without it necessarily being something conscious.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair point. I think there's many things like that. I think there's a scholar who's made the argument that even, and it seems like there's some truth to this, even referring to Judaism as a religion is influenced by a Protestant context in which we live. That the idea of having this religion sort of being like a matter of faith, a matter of the heart, and that's kind of what it connotes, and that traditionally, Judaism is much more all-encompassing in a way that religion maybe doesn't do justice to it. Asher, you also asked, how does Birnbaum deal with Psukkah de Zimmer? What did you mean by that question?
Well, in laying out the differences in the poetry, Psukkah de Zimmer is Tehillim.
Yeah.
It's a certain type of poetry, and so you relate to it a certain way, a different way. In the Koran Siddur, Rabbi Sachs took Adon Olam, which is a song, it's a poem, and Yigdal, which is a poem, and therefore he translated them poetically.
Mm-hmm.
Tehillim is a different form of poetry. It's much more complicated. It's much more subtle. It's something totally different to deal with. And then when you get to Piyutim, as you correctly pointed out at the beginning, the language of Piyutim is way different. It has strange allusions. It's based on a whole different layer. And therefore, it has to be dealt with in a different way. So to compare the three, at, well, at minimum three, but there are different forms in the Hebrew in the prayer in the prayer book. To compare them is to some extent not something you can actually do, because very different and really should be dealt with, I think, in very different ways.
That's a fair point. I have to look and see how Birnbaum deals with Psukkah Zimmer in particular. I don't know if it's, I'm going to notice, I don't know if we're going to notice much difference in the way he's pretty standard in the way he translates across the board, often. But yeah, it's a good point.
I'd like to say something, if I could, very briefly.
Sure.
In the new RCA Sigur, which I am now showing, the English translation of the Tefillah is David de Solapool, as it was all of those years ago that I love so much. And I just want, and he, of course, was the chief minister at Sherith Israel all of those years ago.
We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about that in the final class. I'm going to specifically talk about, I want to specifically talk about that point. Although I do think that the RCA updated the Solapool's translation quite a bit for this edition.
I mean,
that was the basis of it.
If I may, briefly.
Yeah.
I agree with my old friend Art Stein, hi Art, about the poetry, but I'm just surprised that you're surprised, because the whole gist of Anglo-Jewry, particularly the United Synagogue, in the late 19th century in the Edwardian times, was to mimic or to echo the Anglican Church. You know, the United Synagogue was set up to be an imitation of the Church of England. The chief rabbi was, because they wanted an Archbishop of Canterbury all of their own. And, you know, they, frankly, I don't think the average Anglo-Jew at the time could have cared less about the original Hebrew, because they didn't understand a single word of it. And that's why Nina Salomon and Zangwill and all these others made these verses that were attractive to the Victorian Jewish worshipper. And, you know, it's two different, completely different cultures. There's no Hebrew culture or learning culture in England as there was in America, even then. Right.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's very fair. Very fair. I was thinking about saying this actually before, but like, yeah, I can almost imagine people standing in their pews, kind of holding their hymnals, like singing Zangwill's translation in English.
Yeah.
I don't know if people actually did that, but it seems like the type of thing that it was intended for almost.
Yeah. Remember, the rabbi in his pulpit would be wearing canonicals.
Right. Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, but it is interesting, and maybe we'll talk about this a little more in the last class on the RCA Siddur, how the RCA Siddur has gone back and reprinted Zangwill's translations and Salomon's translations, despite the very different context and people that it's aiming their Siddur to. There may also be just cost considerations that go into that. They had the rights to that already, maybe, or I guess that's in the public domain at this point anyway. Yeah, so let's see, what other comments do we have here? Art School's emphasis on being true to the Hebrew is the flip side of Mendelssohn translating Chumash to German with at least a partial motivation of teaching the Jewish population the German language. Yeah, that's true. That is something Mendelssohn was trying to do when he made that translation. Paul asked, did the original Pi Tanim intend their listeners to understand the Pew Team as they heard them? I don't know. That's a really good question. It does seem they were written in a context when people, there seems to be greater facility with the Hebrew language, that people seem to go to shul and I don't know how much they participated, but yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, they say that in like the ancient land of Israel, when a lot of these Piyutim were written, that this would kind of be sort of the religious expression show all the time, that every week the Paitan would come with something new, some new piece of poetry to beautify the tefillah. But I don't know how well they were understood. Judy says it's pretty English to enhance the experience for people who don't know Hebrew. I mean, I think that's certainly part of it. I think for sure. I think that's an important part of it. And I think Dr. Chevelle almost says that in his response a little bit. When criticized by Birnbaum. Okay.
What could be permitted one more question? And from a purely hierarchy point of view, if you were to come to show on Rosh Hashanah and daven exactly like you do on Shabbat, in other words, to do the Shmona Esra and the repetition, and to do no Purim at all, would you be fulfilling your halakhic obligation? I understand that a lot of people would be angry with no Reggie, no Tanatoka, but from a purely halakhic view, could you do that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to say something incorrect because I'm not a halachic expert per se. My understanding is that piyutim are not halachically required, and that really is just, I mean, you have to do the Shemona Esrei, the Rosh Hashanah Shemona Esrei. I think that would be halachically appropriate. But to do these extra piyutim, even Unas HaNatogav, no, I don't think that's halachically required. But I think you're right also to point out that it would be a very different kind of Rosh Hashanah davening, and people would be very surprised. I mean, look at the difference. Like, oftentimes, my understanding is in the Sephardic tradition, Ashkenazic tradition, regular weekday, regular Shabbos, they're not all that different. But Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, they're very different because the selection of piyutim are entirely different. They choose different piyutim in those different traditions. So for sure, like throughout the Jewish world, we have many variations, and the piyutim are not halachically required to say, you know, this particular set of piyutim or to say piyutim at all. But it does very much change the flavor of the davening.
I mean, if I may add, certain poskim were not only you don't have to say they were opposed to many of the piyutim, especially the ones which we basically have cut out in Birkat Kriyat Shema. And what Paul mentioned before, the Marabbas, that they say at Mariv, I've never seen that in my life. But yes, because the people were both. But yes, I totally agree. It makes it very different. I always, if I may, I'd like to tell this story. You know, they have Rabbi Yisrael Salanter when Rosh Hashanah was on Thursday, Friday. So people came to him. They said, this is how I heard it. They came to him. They said they want to end the liver earlier. You know, people have to cook Friday when they're going to get ready, you know, for Shabbos. So what can we cut out from the davening? So Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said, you can cut out Unatana Toke. It's okay. You don't have to say it. Mm-hmm. But what you can't cut out is, because the chazan needs that 3 seconds to catch his breath. That's such a beautiful idea that let the chazan, Unatana Toke, if you can do without it. But of course, and, you know, there are a lot of the things, and, you know, but I agree. The piyutim add to the beauty, and I kind of wish we would say in Mariv. I would like to go to shul once already to say that, and actually to study it, and because they add so much meaning. But anyways,
Let me comment on that. Actually, that's actually interesting. So in terms of the Maravios, I had never heard of them until recently as well. But then one of my friends in the community, he said he grew up saying them, and he's like, I want to start a minyan where we do them on Yom Tov. So for a few years, we actually did that. We met in someone's house and we said them. He moved away, this friend, so we haven't done it since, but it was an interesting experience. It's definitely an interesting experience. I also agree that the chazan definitely need, as a chazan Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, like the chazan needs that break. And if I'm afraid that there's no one there who's going to do it on their own, I like appoint someone ahead of time and say, hey, can you, if I pause, please just start, you know, the Eidodahs, because it is very important for the chazan. But yeah, I mean, also when it comes to like Unas HaNatoga, for example, this was one, technically, again, to the technicalities of piyut, this was a type of piyut called a siluk. A siluk, it means the piyut that's right before Kedusha. There's a whole bunch of piyutim leading up to Kedusha. The siluk, the sort of the withdrawal or the, is the last one for Kedusha. And it was just one siluk for Musaf, Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur, I can't remember which one. And there were many, many others. And throughout the Ashkenazic world, there were all sorts of different traditions at one point about what to use. And Unas HaNatogav was just one option. It seems like for whatever reason, the power of this piyut just grew and grew, and its importance grew, and it's kind of, you know, displaced the other ones. But certainly this is not the way things always were. And it's also interesting, even with piyutim, we do say Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, like we've done all sorts of unusual things with them. Like we've truncated them, we've taken pieces of them, we've mixed and matched them. So they're definitely, over time at least, there's been a lot of changes. Maybe someday I'll give a class about this too, but it's really interesting just to give examples of sort of how there's actually been quite a bit of change in this area, which shows that it doesn't have the same halachic status, but at the same time, it develops kind of a life of its own.
I currently belong to a Reform congregation, and for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, it's basically cut out all the piyutim, but we do have when the Tanakh talks.
That makes sense.
In number 14, in response to Rabbi Charles Chevelle, you didn't translate the last three lines where he refers to the parish of Namu Dalo Dala. Would you know what he was referring to there?
Hold on, let me see. I'd have to look back. I have to look back at how Zangwill translated that phrase. It's probably something very not literal. That's my guess. I have to look back at it.
When the conservative Siddur came out in the 1950s, one of the things that stirred controversy about that Siddur was that they translated it as they dreamed. They used the word, they translated the word Namu to mean that the daughters dreamed, rather than they exclaimed that he poured the water for them.
That's interesting. I'll have to look and see how Zangwill translated that. Okay. That's interesting. Yeah.
Joseph, if I may, one last comment. You didn't mention at all the typography of the Routledge Machzor.
Okay.
Which is really, I think, worth at least a couple of sentences. It is unbelievably boring. You know, there's no variation at all in the type or the layout or anything from, you know, for like 200 pages, which I think was deliberate. I think they wanted to make it like the English hymnal and the Church of, you know, they didn't want any of this sort of hysterical Eastern European big font, large font, small font.
Yeah.
You know, emphasize this, de-emphasize that.
It could very well be, yeah.
You know, I grew up with the Routledge Machzorim. It was horrible. I mean, they're really boring to daven out of.
Yeah.
Unbelievably boring to daven out of.
Yeah. I'm going to talk about this with Birnbaum in next class, actually, I think, because he does the same thing, all the same typeface. And I want to talk about it specifically, because I do think it's a very deliberate choice. And I think it is against kind of the Eastern European model. I will say that, like, as a chazan of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, I've actually been using the Birnbaum a lot of the time, because that was what a lot of the shuls still use. And I'll talk about this more, but oftentimes in many shuls, that's still the official machzor, even if most of the congregants have moved on to something else. And I think at times it does become hard for the chazan because of the lack of differentiation.
Yeah, Nina Salomon, who is an incredibly learned woman, Israel Abrahams called her the most learned Jewish woman in England at the time. She had several children. One of them became an expert on old agricultural farming implements. And his daughter, sadly, is one of the foremost Jewish anti-Zionist, anti-Israel in England. But
interesting.
I
noticed in the Wikipedia article on her, they had, I think it talked a little bit about her children and what some of them did. So if you want to look, see more, other people want to see more about that, that does mention it there.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much. Okay. Next week, Philip Birnbaum will discuss him. And Adam, you're going to talk about, you know, the article in Jewish Action. I think it was Jewish Action about his grave, the whole problem, you know, J.J. Schechter. You know what I'm talking about?
I know, because it was me.
Oh, because it was, okay, I'm sorry, I apologize. So you mentioned it. Okay.
I'll talk about it. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Tonight at 8:30, Mark Shapiro continuing, finishing up our secession controversy that began in Germany, America, Israel, the Hirsch-Bamberger. So that'll be tonight at 8:30, always fascinating. And then tomorrow, Rabbi Shulman on Kohelet, continuing our regular series. Going to go Kohelet probably until Pesach, just to let you know. It's a complicated book, but a fascinating book. And we look forward to learning with you. And please invite a friend to join a class. And, all our classes, Wednesday three classes, Thursday, Parsha, Friday, my class on the Siddur. So we look forward to learning with you and your friends. And everybody be well. We should hear good news and good things. Okay? Have a wonderful day.
Do people know the history of the Leoni Yigdal?
I saw you commented on that. I don't know about that.
Let me give you a quick 5 minute. John Wesley, who is the founder of Methodism, which is quite anti-Anglican church, was wandering by the shul, and he heard Cantor Leoni doing the Yigdal. He immediately went and saw Cantor Leoni, got the music, and he started it, adding a Christian verse at the end. And it then appeared, still appears in many hymnals, especially Protestant hymnals that are mainline. What happened after that was Leoni performed in Handel's Messiah. The Jewish community got really upset, and strangely enough, by sheer coincidence, he was on a boat for Jamaica, where he was cantor in Jamaica and where he's buried, and I visited his grave there.
Okay, interesting. Interesting that Yigdal would have had an additional Christian verse. I'll have to look into that. It sounds interesting.
There's a lot of controversy on Yigdal. Rav Soloveitchik was opposed to the singing of Yigdal, and there has some rumors that the person who composed it was actually was a follower of Christianity. I think was one of was an apostate. I believe that some of the problems with Yigdal. I'm not up on the whole thing, but I know there's a lot of controversy in general surrounding Yigdal, although I miss it. My shul doesn't sing it. I like Yigdal. What can I tell you? Okay. But anyways. All right, everybody. Be well. Hope to see you soon for good occasions. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.